Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I'm so delighted to be talking today with Tara Isabella Burton. She's a contributing editor at The American Interest, a columnist at Religion News Service, and the former staff religion reporter at Vox.com. She is also the author of the novel Social Creature. Her latest book is called Strange Rites. Welcome, Tara.
Hi, thank you. Thank you. I'm delighted to be on.
You contain multitudes. You wrote a dishy, fun thriller a couple of years ago, and now you have a book that's more in line with your training in religious studies. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, theology, religious studies, somewhere in that intersection. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
So my background is in academic theology. I used to be a theologian, and I did my DPhil, what they call a PhD in the UK. But during that time, I realized that the fun thing about a doctoral thesis is that maybe three people read it. Like, you're just hoping your supervisor reads it. And right. I started doing journalism through the doctoral program, particularly journalism about religion, and realized that it's really nice to be able to write for a broader audience, for a general audience, and sort of transitioned into writing about religion, at the same time writing novels or a novel. And it's funny because it feels, in one way, very disparate to have these two worlds. But on the other hand, I feel like they're quite similar, like with both yes. Social Creature and Strange Rites. I was interested in kind of exploring this sort of world of the internet and sort of spiritual emptiness in the age of the internet. And actually both Social Creature starts with a scene at a sort of rave that is inspired by the McKittrick Hotel, this sort of performance art space where Sleep No More is usually performed in New York. And Strange Rites actually starts also with a rave at the literal McKittrick Hotel, which was quite an intentional choice to say, like, we're at these bacchanals in New York, sort of searching for meaning, trying to create something. And it's been really fun and rewarding to look at those questions I'm interested in from two different angles, a sort of intense thriller, but also this book, which is a sort of exploration of the spiritual but not religious, the religious N-O-N-E-S nuns, the religiously remixed, as I call them, anything in that wheelhouse.
I love that you start this book also at McKittrick, because sometimes I forget that religion, part of religion or the religious feeling is the ecstasy, is the joy. Yeah. And you make that so apparent in that opening.
It's funny because I've gone through, I am a Sleep No More, was a super fan, I think still yes. have a connection to that space. And it was something that kind of, I don't know that I would have known or recognized at the time. Like, I was studying theology in the sort of academic way and then going to these parties and being really invested in this world and thinking that actually in many ways I was experiencing a sense of searching, a sense of looking for a home or, you know, a place that could make me feel something, a community. I got involved with other people who were like really into the fandom, and it became this whole world. And I the more that I started, I think I was writing Social Creature before I started writing Strange Rites, but I was still kind of working in similar spaces in journalism. And it really felt like they were just two sides of the same coin of kind of trying to find something meaningful and something, a sense of connection.
Yeah. And so we're supposed to be post-religious, I'm using my air quote fingers, in the 21st century. What is going on?
Sure. So what I would say is, like, everyone says, you know, we are a post-religious age, we're in a secular age. I don't think that's true at right. all. What I think we are in, and what I argue in my book, is that we're in an anti-institutional religious space. Like, religion looks different now. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of, like, numbers and statistics. So about a quarter of Americans say they're religiously unaffiliated. They don't belong to a traditional organized religion or as we traditionally understand it. However, and that number actually goes up to 36% among people born after 1985. So young millennials and Zoomers massively bigger. Also worth saying about queer Americans, it goes up to 46%, so almost double the national average. But that said, the religiously unaffiliated aren't necessarily not religious or not spiritual. 72% of them say they believe in some sort of higher power. And actually 20% of them say they believe in the God of the Bible, as the polling terms it. Hmm. So you have people who have faith in something, maybe even in faith in a God, as Judaism and Christianity, and Islam, but the poll, I think, referred to the Judeo-Christian God. I'll just use their language. Says, that vision of God is something that people still worship, still believe in. So then the question is, like, what are people leaving behind, if not spirituality, if not faith? And I think they're leaving behind institutions. And I think there's a lot of reasons for this. There's a sort of very strong intuitionalist strain in American culture anyway. There's been, all the great awakenings and things like New Thought, which is sort of the secret, but 19th century, spiritualism. All of these movements have always been part of the American landscape. You know, every time the conversation goes something like this, no one really believes anything, and people will go to these churches and it's just, a polite thing you do. We need to bring back like real emotion, real. We need to bring back real faith. And you see this, even in like evangelical revivals of the 19th and 20th century. So part of it's that, part of it is the internet and the kind of cultural shifts that we have as a culture, especially for those of us who grew up with the internet, which I think is a sort of big turning point in this tendency, where there is such a sort of mix and match approach to culture anyway. There's such a sense in, whether it's fan fiction or memes, but the idea that we're not just consumers, but we're also kind of consumer creators. And I think that reflects in how we build our spiritual identities now. There isn't a sense of, often it's there's sort of scholars will talk about the Protestant Reformation and the printing press going hand in hand. And the idea is that, suddenly there's mass literacy or broader middle-class literacy. You can read a book and you can internalize what it says, and you have the sort of inward personal understanding of faith mediated to you by a text that someone else has written, and that you can talk about, the Protestant ethic and sort of inward focuses on salvation and the sort of relatively less clericalism than the Catholic tradition, all coming back to the printing press. I would basically make that analogy that the internet kind of has done the same thing in terms of transforming us for this new, let's mix, let's match. In some ways, it's a return to almost pre-modern oral traditions, where you tell a story and everybody tweaks it a little bit. But it's also in that we can gather digitally and find people who are like us or share our affinities. That's something that I find at once exciting and like somewhat dizzying, that we can kind of create new bonds of community that aren't rooted in like the traditional bonds of community, which might be where you're born, the community around where you're born, where you worship. You're less likely to meet your, let's say, a romantic partner through friends or family or your church. I think 40% of couples now meet online every year. So that's exciting. And then, of course, there's like late capitalism and the fact that how so much of our identities now are rooted in the decisions we make, often the decisions we make in what to buy. But the idea that like our sort of self-definition comes from like, we are looking at these media properties. We're getting our news from these sources. I'm the sort of person who reads Vox, my old employer, or like someone might be the sort of person who reads Colette. That's certainly a personal brand.
That is a, I'd say.
That is a strong choice. but I think that, again, our religious identities become more and more bound up in the sense of what we choose, our desire to mix and match. The term that I like is from Caspar Troicroy and Angie Thurston, who are two Harvard Divinity School scholars, who talk about it as unbundling. They compare it to like your cable package. You have one package. You got your HBO channel and your Showtime, and I don't know the names of any other channels, but you get the drift.
Yeah, and now we have so many different streaming services that we are completely unbundled.
Exactly. Yeah, and the idea too that as we are, this with the streaming service, what you watch means it affects the algorithm of what you're suggested to watch, and so your choices kind of take you further and further down this rabbit hole where what you see, what you consume, is personalized and tailored to you. And for someone who, for example, let's say they're raised Jewish or Christian, and sure, they'll like go Christmas and Easter or the High Holy Days with their family, but also maybe they're doing a Zen Buddhist meditation app. Maybe they're doing yoga. Maybe they're reading tarot cards. Maybe they're going to Soul Cycle or something in that vein. And so the kind of building blocks of religious life, I argue, meaning, you know, why, what's it all for, and purpose, like, what am I for? And community, self-explanatory, and ritual are all things that we don't even necessarily get from the same place. There isn't a holistic, like, it's not a one-stop shop.
Right. And yeah, that definition of religion feels so important, because once I was able to understand these four principles, it's easy to see how in my regular life I have found all of these other outlets. And you talk about so many different subcultures and communities with such empathy.
I mean, it's a world that, especially like in New York, that you do meet people from a variety of, you know, I probably know more witches than Christians, in New York, at least socially. Maybe it's about 50-50 now. But I'm so interested, and I think that there's a kind of danger in writing about these groups, and particularly because I am, I think, quite critical of the sort of capitalist model that sort of commodifies wellness or commodifies, you know, even like witch culture as a brand.
Right.
I think that there's a narrative, and sometimes like more conservative outlets that have thus far read the book are like, want to run with this, where like kids these days are so selfish, like these millennials, they're so solipsistic. And I think that's quite an uncharitable reading of the phenomenon, because the way I see it is like, institutions have catastrophically failed us, like the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal, or, you know, the alliance of white evangelicals with the Trumpist GOP, or even like, if we're not talking about religious institutions, like certainly our democratic norms seem to have failed us, our political system, our media. There's such widespread public distrust of almost every institution.
Yes.
And why, if you can't trust anyone else, if you don't feel you can, which I think is a perfectly understandable impulse, then this sort of inward turn to intuitionalist religion, as I call it, like makes total sense. Like, why wouldn't you turn inward? Why wouldn't you, you know, focus on your wants and your desires and your beliefs as authoritative? And I think that the story I want to tell isn't a story of like selfish millennials being narcissists. It's a story of people, many of whom were or feel themselves to be, and indeed are, marginalized from traditional religious spaces, queer people, women, particularly women who don't, let's just say, see themselves reflected in the gender binary expectations of traditional Christianity is often practiced in this country. I won't say traditional Christianity, because I make the point that it's not the case. But certainly American Christianity. You know, these whether it's sort of modern witchcraft, which is, and witch activism, or it's sort of social justice as a kind of quasi-religious movement, as something that gives you a sense of meaning and purpose. Like,
yes,
these are spaces that exist because traditional spaces have failed.
Yes. And I love that you can make the, you know, Soul Cycle has soul right in the name. And, you know, Goop is selling all sorts of products, but wellness culture is so tied to capitalism.
Yeah.
And yet there are people who it satisfies and makes happy. And
I mean, I think that's such a difficult sort of dynamic. Like, it almost, for so many of these groups and this phenomenon I write about, there is such a sort of love-hate relationship with capitalism, with like neoliberalism, with the idea of like us as being, you know, individuals who can make all these free choices, including like free choices as consumers. And so much like I think about wellness a lot in this because a lot of the buzzwords of wellness are about like authenticity.
Yes.
Or sort of time for yourself or leisure.
Self-care.
Exactly. And those words make sense or make most sense given that a lot of these are expensive and require, if not money, then time, which is also not something that people sort of necessarily have a lot of. And so it becomes this weird, like, you can work hard so that you can take your money and your time and spend it on an authentic experience or the image of an authentic experience, you know, your super pure, sweet green salad. That's a tongue twister. and then you're refreshed, you're rejuvenated, you've had your authentic moment and you go back and therefore you can go and work harder and do it all again. And on the one hand, it's easy to kind of roll your eyes and say like, oh, this is just capitalist and it is bad. But also there is a very real hunger for something that is authentic, something that is real. There is I think a very profound sense that a lot of people have that the world of capitalism is a world that is inherently alienating. And so there's sort of all these ways that I think people try to get out of it or try to escape it. But because we live in this world and because corporations are so able to monetize and use these impulses for their own ends, it then becomes sort of commodified. Like, I'm just thinking, for example, of my favorite example of this is did you ever know the Red Door Salon, the Elizabeth Arden?
Oh, yeah.
So that was all, so much of the rhetoric around that, the imagery was about glamour and beauty and like a certain kind of wealth. In 2018, it's now closed down, but in 2018, I believe, maybe 2019, it switched to Mind, M-Y-N-D. That was the rebrand. And the whole rebrand was your self-care journey. A self-care journey you can really say is truly my, just like the most awkward tagline ever.
Mind.
It's Mind. And I just thought that was such an interesting sort of example of how, our sort of cultural aspirations have changed in the way in which corporations want to brand things. They don't necessarily brand things as sexy or explicitly. Okay, it's not explicitly about wealth or sexiness. It's more explicitly about self-care and virtue and goodness, but it's still also a little bit about wealth.
I mean, how could it not be? Another area that you talk about, which I've been thinking about a lot lately, is fandoms and how the internet brings people together and lets them add on to the worlds that have already been built and remix the canonical with the...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking about this a lot week watching sort of after J.K. Rowling's transphobic tweets, and then they're doubling down. Now, I think there's a sort of world in which a response might be something like, let's not read her books anymore, Harry Potter is dead to us. But instead, it seemed that so many fans were saying things along the lines of like, well, it's not her world, it's our world. We don't need J.K. Rowling's Hogwarts. We have our own Hogwarts now. Let's write and read more fan fiction. Let's kind of enjoy this world without the creator. And I think that's so telling in part because Harry Potter has always been a bit of a kind of cultural canary in the coal mine for the development of fandom. A fun fact that I always like is that between 1997 and 2000, which is between the first and fourth Harry Potter book publications, at-home internet use went from 19 million to 100 million in America.
Yes.
So like the rise of personal internet and the kind of internet culture was directly correlated with this cultural phenomenon. And at every stage, the Harry Potter sort of led the way for fan fiction and thinking about kind of remixing texts. Then the sort of development of forums and also the way in which kind of cultural properties can become, and particularly non-religious cultural properties, can become these kind of sacred texts in and of themselves. More people probably know the name of the Harry Potter houses than the four gospels, which is to say that's the number of people who know the four gospels, or percentage rather, versus the number of people who've seen or read at least one Harry Potter movie or book.
Right.
So suddenly it's like, these are our cultural touchstones. This is how we talk about, someone a Slytherin or someone a Gryffindor. Everyone knows that what that means.
And it's been really inspiring to see groups like the Harry Potter Alliance and all of these other fan communities that have gone on to make something really beautiful out of out of something that is increasingly ugly in the creator's mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think it's so sort of striking and fascinating that, you know, there's we don't feel culturally obligated to sort of respect a creator's wishes. There's not a sort of authoritarian sense of top-down hierarchy. You know, this person is the writer, this person has a certain authority. It's, they have said something and now we are all reworking it in our own way. And as I said earlier, you know, that's also the sort of pre-literary tradition, you know, whether it's the various sort of Greek myths being told and retold in different ways, different variants of the Arthurian myth. And I actually find that so exciting to think about that creative force.
It is. Okay, so now we're going to take a turn and talk about some of the less exciting religious-ish groups that you talk about, including, you call them the atavists.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So I use that term to talk about a kind of range of reactionary, mostly male groups and people from like Jordan Peterson on the still pretty right wing, but like possibly within like the bounds of normalcy-ish. That was sort of, this was written before he went into like a meat coma. And the sort of alt-right on the other end of the fringe, but groups of people who I think, again, possibly think of themselves as opposed to all the phenomena I talk about. They'll talk about, you know, tradition and returning back to the good old days where like some sort of hybrid mashup of ancient Greece as seen through like Hercules' legendary journeys and 1950s America, where, you know, men were men and women were women and people knew their place with all of the racial and gendered and with all the bigotry that implies.
Yes, yes. Lots of bigotry.
The subtext is text. but there's a sort of, whether it's eating an all-meat diet or kind of embracing a kind of evo-psych vision of, say, scientifically dubious evo-psych vision of humanity, where like biology says that like men want to have multiple sex partners and women shouldn't, and here's what that means. And I think that these groups sort of, what I find so fascinating is that once they would say like, oh, the evil feminist politically correct establishment has made the world terrible and we're trying to go back and get away from this modern world. And yet the ways in which they manifest that desire, whether it's posting on 4chan and Reddit, and like the red pill men's rights subreddits, or whether it's you know, taking supplements from Alex Jones, they're doing the same thing. They're doing the same kind of self-help, turning inwards, self-improvement thing that Gwyneth Paltrow is doing. Alex Jones and Gwyneth Paltrow actually sell chemically identical supplements. It's the same thing with just different branding. But I think that said, certainly there are spillovers of this kind of bizarre kind of combination of toxic ideology with sort of faux nostalgia for imagined past, with a kind of weird internet nihilism where like nothing matters, let's burn it all down because the world is empty to us, that can lead over and spill over into real life and has spilled over into real world violence. And so that is something that is perhaps distinct to this group among the groups I write about. But I think that what I find so interesting is that an odd consensus that I think one can identify while still being extremely, extremely condemnatory of this group. I think that there's an awareness more broadly shared that our institutions have failed us, that our, whether it is, again, political establishment, journalistic establishment, academic establishment in some ways. And I think that, you know, it is telling that there's on this idea that is so shared, some kernel of an awareness that our systems are broken. Mm-hmm. And how do we deal with that? And it is as true from, you know, it is we see on sort of among progressives, whom I count myself one, certainly this awareness that like Yes, the system is broken. Like, we all seem to agree that the system is broken here. It's just, you know, the sheer variety of interpretations why and how opposite those can be is also telling.
Tell me that you don't hit on this in the book, but I'm just curious about, tell me where QAnon falls into all of this.
Sure. So they're another group that I think could have made it in. There's always, you know, especially with book timing, there's so much more that happened the past year that's not in the book. But I think that these sort of conspiracy theories more broadly come from this place, again, of like complete breakdown of trust combined with, I think, this distinctively American sense that like, we are so powerful that if we just look inward, like we can figure it out. Cause it's not just the world is broken. Like that sucks. What do we do? Just go on with it. Which is often like, I think accounts of, Soviet era disillusionment or a response to kind of disinformation in that context often seem to have lent itself to this kind of resigned fatalism where like, we all know that we are in a sort of false world, but what's to be done? And yet I think that the sort of quintessentially American narrative that like, if you just focus, you can figure it out. You could be the hero. You could be that Nick Cage character. And I'm forgetting the movie now, but like the guy who figures it all out.
The guy who figures it all out.
Oh no, it's not Nick Cage. It's Die Hard, you know,
Bruce Willis.
There we go. Easy mistake to make.
A good cop.
Oh gosh, I even forgot about that. But that is that sort of like, well, if I, you know, the media can't figure it out and the journalists can't figure it out and politics and positions can't figure it out, but I, with like my YouTube connection, I can figure it out. And that is, I think, so quintessentially American.
Tara, tell me what you've enjoyed reading lately, both as a theologian and as a novelist.
Sure. So I just read a book that came out a couple of weeks ago by Anbara Salam, called Belladonna, and it is fascinating. So it's about a love triangle among three women in 19, two American art students and a nun in 1950s Italy. And it's great, and it deals a lot with questions, not just, it's sort of this sort of quintessential first love summer novel, but extremely subversive, dealing with queer desire. It deals a lot with race and racial politics, both the protagonist and the nun are mixed, and the protagonist is sort of hiding this fact. She's half Egyptian, half American, and there's a sort of interesting doubling that goes on with sort of different characters' relationships to their identities, and it's just beautifully written. I read it in one sitting, so that is my recommendation on fiction. As a nonfiction, I'm reading Jack Jenkins's American Prophets, which also just came out, which is a study of the religious left in America and an argument that we don't that there is a resounding, not as big as the religious right, but a strong politically motivated religious left in America and always has been. And so that's an argument that I'm very glad to see someone make, and then I think Jack does a really good job of making.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.